I have a confession to make today.
Yeah.
And I feel like this is a safe space for us to dive into this. I basically have a problem with my portfolio app.
Oh, no. Are you
Yeah.
checking it every 5 minutes again? I mean, you talked about this.
It's not just checking it. It's this literal paralysis. I was sitting there last night. It's like 11:30 p.m. The blue light is just totally frying my retinas, and I am staring at my cash balance.
Yeah.
And I have this overwhelming, almost suffocating feeling of, what do I buy next? It's like the universal anxiety of the modern investor, you know?
Right.
We are just obsessed with the what.
The what,
It's
right.
like, what is the ticker? What is the hot sector right now? Is it chips? Is it biotech? What did the hedge funds just file in their 13Fs? It's just exhausting.
It is exhausting, and frankly, it is a total recipe for disaster.
Yeah.
But what if I told you that the entire obsession, that specific anxiety keeping you up at 11:30, is actually based on the completely wrong question?
See, I kind of knew you were going to say that. You always love flipping the script on me. But seriously, if what should I buy is the wrong question, then what on earth is the right one? Because I feel like my retirement literally depends on the what.
The source material we are jumping into for our deep dive today, it's this massive, just brain-bending series called Averaging Up by Jocelyn Dubey,
Right, yeah.
and specifically the part titled The Infinite Investor. It argues that the what is a trap. The better question, the one that actually leads to generational wealth for you, is why does it compound?
Why does it compound? Okay, that sounds, I mean, it sounds nice, maybe a little philosophical, sort of academic.
It is philosophical, sure, but it's also the most practical thing you can ask. Think about it. The what gives you a list of tickers? It gives you names. Buy NVIDIA, buy Ford,
Yeah.
buy Apple.
Yeah.
But it also gives you severe anxiety because you don't actually know if you are right. You are basically renting someone else's conviction.
That is so true.
Yeah.
Because if I buy a stock just because some guy on TV yelled the name or because I saw it trending on Reddit, the second it drops 10%, I am panic selling. I have absolutely no anchor.
Exactly. The what provides zero emotional armor, but the why gives you understanding. And understanding is the only thing that gives you the stomach to hold an asset when the market crashes 30%.
Right.
If you know why the machine works, you don't panic when the car makes a weird noise.
Okay, that's a really fair point. So, where does this take us? Looking at the notes for today's deep dive, we aren't exactly talking about P/E ratios or reading balance sheets. I see physics
We are absolutely talking about physics today.
and chemistry
Chemistry, yes.
and thermodynamics. Like, really?
It is entirely central to the thesis.
You are telling me I need to understand the second law of thermodynamics to pick a stock. I thought we ran a finance show, not a refresher on high school science.
According to this framework, yes, you actually do. Because the core argument Dubey makes is that the best businesses in the world, the ones he calls free surfers, they don't just get lucky.
Okay.
They obey natural laws. They are structural, inevitable forces. They aren't just businesses. They are physical systems that are essentially surfing on top of entropy.
I actually love this. I love the idea that there is a physics to money. It makes it feel a lot less like gambling and more like engineering. So let's unpack this before we get into the heavy science. The source material talks about a core framework involving two variables, A and B.
Right, A and B.
This seems to be the foundation of everything else. So let's not rush this part. What exactly are we talking about with A and B?
This is the exact lens through which you have to view every single company from now on. Dubey decomposes a business into two distinct parts, variable A and variable B.
Variable A. Let's start there. What is it?
A is the engine. It is the existing revenue. It's the moat. It's the cash flow generated by what the business is already doing today.
Right, the stuff currently happening.
Exactly. If the business stopped growing tomorrow, if they never signed a single new customer, A is what keeps the lights on, pays the salaries, and funds the dividends.
Got it. So A is the status quo. It's the legacy business, the recurring revenue from the loyal customers you already have.
Precisely. Now, variable B. This is where most investors get confused and where the actual magic happens. B is the cost of growth.
The cost of growth.
Technically, it is the capital required to generate the next dollar of revenue.
Okay, let's pause on that for a second because usually when I think of costs, I'm thinking of operating expenses, rent, electricity, marketing budgets. Is that what B is?
No, and that is a really crucial distinction to make. We aren't talking about the cost to run the business. We are talking about the capital cost to expand the business. Let's use a really simple analogy. Say you run a lemonade stand.
I love a good lemonade stand.
Yeah.
A true classic.
So you have a stand, you have a pitcher, and you have some lemons. You are selling 100 cups a day. That is your variable A. You are making money. But now you want to sell 200 cups a day. You want growth.
Right. I want that sweet, sweet growth. I want to scale.
What do you have to do to get it?
Well, I mean, I probably need more lemons. I might need a much bigger pitcher. If the line gets way too long, I might need to hire my little brother to help me pour. Heck, if I want to go really big, I might need to buy wood and build a second stand down the street.
Exactly. You need to buy wood for the second stand. You need to buy a second pitcher. You need to pay your brother a wage. You need fresh inventory. All of that is capital. That is what we call a hybe. To get the next dollar of revenue, you have to spend a significant amount of money up front.
I see. So growth is definitely not free. I have to invest heavily just to grow.
In the physical world of atoms, yes. Think about a railroad. This is the classic heavy B business.
Mm-hmm.
If a railroad company wants to haul twice as much freight next year, what do they have to do?
Oh, man. They have to literally lay new steel tracks. They have to buy those massive diesel locomotives.
Right.
They have to hire conductors, engineers, dispatchers.
And maintain the bridges. And tunnel through actual mountains. It is incredibly capital intensive. To make a single new dollar, they might have to spend 50 cents or more in capital expenditure just to build the capacity.
It sounds heavy. It sounds exhausting, honestly.
It is heavy. It's pure friction. Now, contrast that with the holy grail of this framework. The condition that every investor listening to this should be hunting for, the free B.
The free B, which implies what? That growth literally costs zero.
Effectively, yes. Imagine a business where the cost to generate the next dollar of revenue is zero. You don't need a new factory. You don't need new steel rails. You don't need to hire 1,000 new people.
Does that actually exist in the real world? It sounds like financial perpetual motion.
It totally exists. Jubei calls these businesses free surfers. A free surfer is a business that has a free B0 cost of growth and is simultaneously riding a growing wave of demand.
Okay, anchor this concept for me. Give me the perfect real-world example.
The archetype, the classic example used throughout the source material is Visa.
Visa, the little credit card logo in my wallet.
Think about the underlying physics of Visa. Global payments are growing, let's just say, 8 to 10% a year. People are switching from cash to digital globally. The broader economy expands.
Yeah, inflation pushes prices up too.
Exactly. So Visa's revenue naturally grows 8 to 10% a year alongside that transaction volume. Now ask yourself, what is the cost for Visa to capture that extra growth?
Well, I mean, they already built the network, right? They already have the huge data centers.
Exactly. If you buy a coffee for $5 today, or if you and 10 of your friends all buy coffees, does Visa need to lay new fiber optic cables under the ocean?
No. They don't.
Do they need to build a brand new headquarters to process it? Do they need to hire a new coffee transaction specialist?
No, because it's just bits. It's just software.
It's just electrons moving through the pipes they already laid 30 years ago. The cost to process that extra volume, the marginal cost, is effectively zero.
So the top line revenue goes up, but the capital costs stay completely flat.
Which means all that new money falls straight to the bottom line. That is a freebie. And when you combine that with a massive secular trend, like the structural death of cash, you have a free surfer. You are surfing a wave of massive growth, and you didn't have to spend a dime paddling to catch it.
That explains the name perfectly. Free surfer,
yeah.
You are getting a free ride on a structural wave.
Precisely. And this leads us directly into the first major scientific concept in the deep dive, the gradient.
The gradient.
Okay.
I vaguely remember gradients from high school physics class. It's about slope, right?
Right.
Or direction.
In physics, a gradient is a directional force. Think about heat. If it's freezing outside in the winter and you open your living room window, what does the heat do?
It rushes right out. It goes straight from the warm house out into the cold.
Right. You don't have to tell the heat to move. You don't have to stand there and push it. It just does. It naturally flows from hot to cold. That is the second law of thermodynamics. Or think about water. It flows from high ground down to low ground. It simply follows gravity.
It naturally takes the path of least resistance.
Exactly. It's not a conscious decision. It is an immutable law. Now, Debye argues that capital money itself has a gradient, too. It behaves exactly like energy.
So where does money naturally want to go? If money is water, where is downhill?
Capital naturally flows from high B to zero B. It flows from the heavy, expensive growth down toward the free, frictionless growth. It migrates away from atoms and toward bits.
From atoms to bits. That is such a great visual. It's like money is constantly trying to escape the gravity of the physical world.
That is a perfect way to put it. Money hates friction. Building a car factory is friction. Dealing with raw material supply chains is friction. Rust is friction. Software, data, digital networks, those are entirely frictionless. And the source claims this isn't just a pretty metaphor for a textbook. You can actually measure it in real time by looking at where the smartest capital in the world is moving.
And this is where the source brings up Chris Hahn. Now, for the listeners who might not track hedge fund managers like they are rock stars, Chris Hahn is an absolute legend. He runs TCI Fund Management. His track record over the decades is absurd. He's in the gambler. He is a strategic sniper.
He is arguably one of the best capital allocators of his generation. And if you closely look at Hahn's moves in 2025, over just three quarters, he made a very specific, very dramatic portfolio shift. He sold a massive position in Canadian Pacific Kansas City.
Which is a major railroad.
A railroad, the ultimate heavy B business. Atoms, steel, diesel fuel, labor.
Now, wait a second. Railroads are supposed to be great businesses in a way. They're natural monopolies. You can't exactly just buy some land to build another railroad next to an existing one. Warren Buffett famously loves railroads. Why would a genius like Hahn sell a monopoly?
Because of the gradient. Yes, it is a monopoly, but it is a very heavy monopoly. Think about inflation. This is a key point the source makes perfectly clear. In an inflationary world, replacing your steel rails costs significantly more. Buying new diesel locomotives costs more. Your B variable gets vastly more expensive. Inflation violently hurts heavy B businesses because their basic maintenance capital expenditures explode.
Ah, I see. So the cost of just staying the exact same place goes up. You're running on a treadmill that's speeding up.
Exactly. So Hahn dumps the heavy railroad. And what did he systematically buy with all that money?
Let me guess. He went surfing.
He loaded up heavily on Visa, Moody's, and S&P Global.
Moody's and S&P, those are the big credit rating agencies.
Yes. Think of them as information toll booths. If a large company or a government wants to issue debt, which pretty much every entity does, they are legally or practically required to pay Moody's or S&P for a credit rating.
And what is the actual cost for Moody's to generate and issue that rating?
A few really smart analysts in an office, some proprietary algorithms, and a legacy brand name. They don't have to build a new factory to rate a corporate bond. It is purely intellectual capital. It is a zero B.
So Hahn wasn't just picking random stocks or looking at moving averages on a chart?
No, he was directly following the gradient. He was moving his billions of capital from a high B environment, railroads and atoms, to a zero B environment, data and bits. He was letting his capital flow downhill to the path of least resistance.
It's fascinating because it completely frames investing not as guessing the future, but as aligning yourself with nature.
Mm.
And the source mentions that even Warren Buffett, the very guy who bought the Burlington Northern Railroad, has actually been doing this exact thing his whole career.
It's the exact same overarching arc. Look at where Buffett started out. What was Berkshire Hathaway originally?
It was a textile mill up in New England.
The ultimate mathematically bad business, heavy physical machinery, razor-thin margins, brutal foreign competition. You had to constantly keep buying new looms just to stay alive. Heavy atoms. Heavy B.
And he famously hated it. I think he calls it his literal worst trade ever.
Right. So where did he pivot to? He moved heavily into insurance float, financial instruments, a much lighter B. Then where did he go over the decades? What is his absolute biggest holding today?
Apple.
Apple. A massive tech platform. And through his portfolio managers, he owns Visa, MasterCard, Moody's. He has slowly, over 50 long years, migrated his empire from heavy physical atoms to weightless digital bits.
It is an implicit endorsement of the theory. Even the Oracle of Omaha, who famously loves real businesses you can touch and kick, eventually surrendered to the physics of the gradient.
He had to. Smart capital always migrates to where compounding is easiest. Why struggle and sweat to push a heavy rock up a hill like running a textile mill when you can just let water flow downhill with a business like Visa?
Okay, so that is a gradient. Capital always seeks efficiency. But I want to push back on something here.
Sure.
Trends eventually end. You know, hula hoops were a massive trend. Beanie Babies were a trend. Even in real business, things constantly change. MySpace was an unstoppable trend until Facebook killed it. How do we know digital payments isn't just a long phase? How do we know we won't revert back to cash or something else entirely?
That is the trillion-dollar question for an investor. And this brings us to the second core pillar of the deep dive, irreversibility.
Irreversibility.
This connects right back to thermodynamics, specifically the concept of entropy.
Entropy. Right. Measure of disorder in a system.
Exactly. The second law says entropy always increases in a closed system. And much more importantly for us, time is unidirectional. You can crack and break an egg, but you cannot unbreak that egg. You can burn a wooden log into ash, but you cannot turn that pile of ash back into a log.
Okay, I conceptually get the egg, but how does this actually apply to my Visa card?
Dubé essentially argues that the best secular trends, the ones that permanently power these free surfers, are thermodynamically irreversible, meaning for the trend to actually reverse course, it would require more raw energy than the system currently possesses.
So you were saying we literally can't go back to cash because of physics?
Let's look closely at the Visa case study provided in the source. It breaks down the entire digitalization of payments into four very independent actors. You have governments, banks, merchants, and consumers.
Okay, let's role play this out. This is the thought experiment from the text. I am going to be the devil's advocate here. I'm the guy who says cash is king. I really like my privacy. I don't want the federal government tracking my latte purchases.
Okay, I'll play along.
So for the trend to fully reverse, for all of us to go back to primarily using paper cash, what actually has to happen?
All four of those actors would have to simultaneously decide they greatly prefer cash. Not just one of them making a fuss, all of them. Because right now, they're all pushing the same flywheel in the same direction.
Okay, let's start with the government. Why do they inherently hate cash?
Traceability and taxes. You cannot easily hide a digital transaction. Cash is the historical currency of the black market. It's the currency of tax evasion. So for the government to suddenly want a broad return to cash, they would have to actively prefer tax evasion, money laundering, and total opacity.
Which they never will.
Yeah.
Governments are perpetually hungry beasts. They desperately want their tax revenue.
Correct. So the government is permanently locked into digital. Now, what about the banks?
Banks. Well, they obviously make a ton of money on the transaction fees.
Exactly. Every single time you swipe your card, they get a small cut, interchange fees. But more than that, cash is physically expensive for a bank. You have to store it in giant vaults. You have to hire armored trucks to securely move it around the city. You have to pay armed security guards to watch it.
So cash is actually a massive physical cost for them. Digital is pure revenue.
Right. So for banks to suddenly prefer cash, they would need to actively prefer earning zero fees while simultaneously paying much higher security and logistics costs.
Okay, zero chance of that happening. What about the merchants, the local shop owners?
Speed and efficiency. Think about the checkout line at a busy grocery store. Tapping a phone or a card takes exactly 1 second. Counting out physical change takes real time, and time is money. Plus, there is the risk of theft. It is infinitely harder to rob a digital merchant wallet than it is to hold up a physical cash register.
True. If I run a busy coffee shop, I definitely don't want my teenage employees handling hundreds in cash all day if I can avoid it. It's just risky.
So merchants would essentially need to prefer slower checkout lines, lower throughput, and higher employee theft.
Okay, so that is three massive structural actors against one. But what about me, the individual consumer? I mentioned my privacy concerns earlier. What if I just really prefer the tactile feel of paper money?
You personally might, but let's look at your actual behavior, not your stated ideals. Convenience is the ultimate human gradient. Do you really want to drive to the ATM every single week? Do you want to carry a bulky physical wallet everywhere? Do you want to deal with gross loose change rattling around in your pocket? Or do you just want to double-click the side of your phone and walk away with your item?
I haven't carried a real physical wallet in probably 6 months. I panic if I forget my phone at home, but I literally don't even know if I have a single dollar bill on me right now.
Exactly. Convenience is a lower energy state. It takes vastly less energy to tap a phone than it does to manage, fold, and carry physical currency. So look at the entire system from above. For the trend to actually reverse, governments, banks, merchants, and consumers would all have to act forcefully against their own direct self-interest, all at the exact same time.
Effectively impossible in the real world.
It is a zero probability event. It is structural entropy. The complex system has simply moved to a much more efficient state, a lower energy state, and there is no existing force strong enough to push that giant boulder back up the hill. You truly can't unbreak the egg.
That is just such a powerful way to think about growth. It's not a shaky Wall Street forecast. Analysts are always on CNBC like, oh, we forecast 12% growth next quarter based on our recent channel checks. But this isn't a forecast at all. It is a structural reality.
Right. You don't need to try and predict if it will continue next quarter. You just need to step back and ask, Is there a plausible physics-based scenario where this entirely reverses? If the answer is no, you have an irreversible wave.
Does this specific logic apply to other industries? Or is Visa just a freak unicorn?
It applies beautifully to the other free surfers, too. Look at S&P Global and Moody's again. The underlying trend is the growth of global capital markets.
Explain that one a bit more. Why exactly is that irreversible?
Because the modern world runs entirely on credit. Governments run on debt to build bridges and fund programs. Corporations run on debt to build software and factories. As the global economy naturally grows, the total volume of debt issuance inherently grows. And that debt legally requires a rating to be sold to institutional investors. It's hardwired into the system.
So unless we suddenly revert back to a primitive barter economy or a purely cash-based feudal system,
S&P Global is basically guaranteed to have more volume over the next decade. It is entirely irreversible. Or we can look at MSCI.
MSCI is the big index company, right? They make the MSCI World Index and things like that.
Yes. They basically create and license the mathematical indices that massive ETFs and mutual funds track. The irreversible trend there is the tectonic shift from active investing, which is stock pickers trying to beat the market, to passive investing, which is just buying the index funds.
And that has been a massive multi-decade tidal wave.
It's historically huge, and it is thermodynamically irreversible. Why? Because the academic data definitively proves active managers underperform over the long run. The management fees are drastically lower for passive, and new regulations continuously favor transparency. For that specific trend to reverse, millions of investors would have to simultaneously decide they hate making market returns and actively love paying high fees to guys in suits.
Put me down for a solid, not going to happen on that one.
Exactly. So when you can find a business with a 0B, meaning free growth, that is also riding an irreversible wave, meaning entropy, you have found something incredibly special. But here's where the chemistry part comes in. It can actually get even faster.
Oh, good. Because physics and thermodynamics clearly weren't enough for one day. Now we're doing chemistry.
We have to, because we need a framework to explain acceleration. This brings us right to section 3 of the deep dive, autocatalysis.
Autocatalysis. Okay, that is a $5 academic word. Break it down for me.
In chemistry, an autocatalytic reaction is a specific reaction where the product of the reaction is the exact catalyst for the reaction itself.
Okay, can we get that in plain English?
Think of a simple fire. You light a match and hold it to a piece of dry wood. The heat from that small flame releases combustible gas from the wood. That gas burns. The burning gas creates more heat, which releases more gas from the log, which creates more heat. The fire inherently feeds itself. Once you start it, you don't need to stand there holding a match to it forever. It sustains and grows all by itself.
Got it. The output literally becomes the input. It's a self-feeding loop.
Yes. Now, let's strictly apply this concept to MSCI and artificial intelligence. This is honestly one of the most fascinating and counterintuitive insights in the entire deep dive.
How does AI fit into this? I mean, everyone is talking about AI right now, but usually it's just, you know, buy NVIDIA because they make the fast chips.
Yeah.
How does an AI boom actually help a boring index provider?
Most people completely miss this connection. Dubé argues that AI is actually an incredible accelerant for the total financialization of the market. Think about how AI fundamentally works. What does it critically need to function?
Data. Just massive mountains of clean data.
And what does it aggressively look for in that data?
Patterns. Rules. Yeah. Stuff it can optimize.
Exactly. AI always optimizes for systematic, strict rules-based allocation. It doesn't operate on gut feelings. It doesn't care if a CEO gave a really charismatic interview. It operates on cold algorithms. Well, what exactly is an index? What is the S&P 500 or the MSCI World?
It's just a rule. It's a rule that says buy the 500 biggest companies and rebalance quarterly.
Exactly. Passive investing is algorithmic investing. It is the exact environment AI wants. So the more AI broadly enters the global financial world, the more capital it relentlessly moves toward rules-based passive strategies.
Which means more trillions flow into the products licensed by MSCI.
Right. Let's trace the loop step by step. Step one, the broader shift to passive investing happens. That's the underlying wave. Step two, highly advanced AI enters the game to help institutions manage money.
Yeah.
Step three, the AI mathematically prefers indices and rules over human stock picking. Step four, this drives even more massive assets into passive index funds. Step five, this creates a surge of new licensing revenue for MSCI.
And then what do they do with that cash?
Step 6, MSCI uses that massive revenue to buy even more alternative data and build way better analytics tools directly for AI.
Wow. So the reaction genuinely provides its own energy. MSCI doesn't even really need a traditional sales team at that point. The underlying market structure itself is literally selling the product for it.
Precisely. No massive external push is fundamentally required. It is an autocatalytic reaction. The fire is creating its own intense heat.
But I kind of feel like I have to be the cynical buzzkill here. Nothing in the real world grows forever. A fire eventually runs entirely out of wood.
That is correct. And the source material is very logically honest about this reality. It explicitly warns us about the sigmoid curve.
The S curve. I know this one from basic economics. Everything looks like an S eventually.
Right. Autocatalytic reactions aren't mathematically infinite. They follow a very specific biological shape. Phase one is latency, a very slow start. The fire is just faintly flickering. Phase two is exponential. Explosive, compounding growth. The fire absolutely roars. Phase three is the plateau. The fuel runs out. The fire slowly dies down to embers.
So the real danger for an investor, the ultimate trap, is buying in right at the plateau.
Mm.
Thinking the explosive exponential growth will last for decades, but you are actually sitting right at the top of the S-curve.
Exactly. You constantly have to ask yourself, where on the sigmoid curve am I right now?
So where are we exactly with MSCI and this whole AI-driven passive investing wave? Are we nearing the end of the fuel?
We need to carefully look at the substrate, the actual fuel. In this specific case, the fuel is active management assets, the global money that is not yet passive, the trillions still sitting with human stock pickers and high-fee legacy mutual funds.
How much of that is actually left to convert?
Right now, passive is roughly 50% of the U.S. equity market.
So half the giant pile of wood is still totally unburnt.
Exactly. That is a truly massive amount of fuel left to burn through. And with AI aggressively acting as the accelerant, basically pouring gallons of gasoline on the fire, the strict verdict in the source is that we are still deeply in the exponential phase. We are very far from the plateau. The runway is incredibly long.
Okay, that is very encouraging. So we have physics driving the broader direction, thermodynamics ensuring it literally cannot go backwards, and chemistry making it burn faster.
That is the upside triad, but we absolutely need to talk about the downside.
I was definitely waiting for this, because stock markets are notoriously scary places. They crash. They burn people out. I vividly remember 2008. I remember 2020. You can have all the theoretical physics you want, but when your screen goes red and the market violently drops 50%, it really feels like the laws of physics are completely broken.
It always feels that way. And this brings us straight to the math section of the deep dive, specifically the work of two absolute giants of mathematics, Benoit Mandelbrot and Claude Shannon.
Mandelbrot. The fractal geometry guy, right? I remember seeing those crazy psychedelic poster prints in college dorm rooms.
The very same guy. But Mandelbrot didn't just draw cool, trippy shapes. He totally revolutionized how we structurally understand market risk. He famously warned us that the terrain is hostile.
Hostile house, exactly.
Standard modern finance, the stuff they rigidly teach in MBA programs, uses the bell curve, the normal distribution.
Right. The smooth curve where everything neatly clusters in the boring middle and extreme crazy events are supposed to be super rare.
According to the strict math of the bell curve, a massive market crash like 1987 or 2008 should only happen roughly once every billion years.
But they actually happen like, what, every 8 to 10 years?
Exactly. The math was wrong. Mandelbrot mathematically proved that financial markets are actually fat-tailed. The extreme tails of the distribution, the massive wipeouts and crashes, are much, much thicker than the bell curve models predict. Risk isn't mild in the market. It is wild.
So the world is inherently way riskier than we are taught to think.
Much riskier. Yeah. And this constant wildness creates what Dubé explicitly calls the volatility tax.
I really love that term, the volatility tax. Mm. It sounds like some awful new thing the IRS invented, but it is purely mathematical. Break the math down for us.
It is the brutal mathematical penalty of taking losses. Let's play a really quick game. You have exactly $100.
Okay, I have my $100.
The wild market crashes. You lose 50%. How much do you have left?
I have $50.
Now the market recovers fully. You gain 50%.
Right.
How much do you have now?
Well, 50% of $50 is $25. So I have $75.
You lost real money. The average return over those two periods was technically 0 minus 50, then plus 50, but you permanently lost 25% of your total wealth. That missing $25 is the volatility tax.
That is just brutal, inescapable math.
And it gets so much worse. If you drop 50%, you mathematically need a 100% gain just to get back to even. The hole gets deeper far faster than you can reasonably climb out of it. In a wild, fat-tailed market, which is Mandelbrot's world big losses, absolutely destroy the magic of compounding. Simple survival is the strict prerequisite to wealth.
So if the market is basically a wild beast that actively wants to eat my compounding, how do I actually survive? How do I pay less of this tax?
Enter Claude Shannon, the literal father of information theory. He was an absolute genius working at Bell Labs. He came up with a brilliant mathematical concept called Shannon's demon.
That sounds slightly ominous. Is it the good demon or a bad demon for me?
It is a very benevolent demon. Mm. Shannon proved mathematically that you can actually create positive compounding returns from a highly volatile asset that has zero expected long-term return just by mechanically rebalancing your portfolio.
That sounds kind of like financial alchemy, like trying to create gold from lead. Explain how that demon actually works.
Imagine you have a rebalancing robot. You hand it two buckets. Bucket A is just safe cash. Bucket B has a crazy volatile stock. The robot has one unbreakable rule. Keep the dollar value of the buckets exactly equal. 50-50.
Okay. Always 50-50.
The wild stock doubles in price. Now your stock bucket is way too huge. What does the robot mechanically do?
It has to sell some of the stock and put cash in the other bucket to get back to 50-50.
So it forces you to sell high. It banks the profit. Now imagine the next day the stock crashes 50%. The stock bucket is now way too small. What does the robot do?
It takes cash out of bucket A and buys the crushed stock.
So it forces you to buy low. By mechanically rebalancing without ever trying to predict the future, just rigidly following a rule, the robot forces you to consistently buy low and sell high. You are actively extracting wealth from the raw volatility. You create pure order out of noise.
That is amazing. It's like turning the very chaos of the market into actual fuel for your returns.
It is brilliant. But here is the massive practical problem. Doing that flawlessly as a human being is incredibly hard. It's wildly expensive due to capital gains taxes and trading fees, and emotionally, it is almost impossible. Are you really going to actively buy a ton of stock on the scariest day of a crash?
Probably not. Honestly, I'd just be hiding under my bed, hugging my dog.
Exactly. We are humans. So here is the concept of the inverted Shannon's demon. This is the ultimate key insight about why free surfers are so powerful.
Okay, lay the demon on me.
Active traders frantically try to be Shannon's demon by buying and selling all the time, jumping in and out. But the free surfer company does this internally, deep inside the business model, without you ever lifting a single finger.
How do they internalize it?
Think carefully about the structure of Visa again. You have the A variable, the deep moat, the existing payment network. When the global market crashes, people still have to buy groceries. They still pay their Netflix subscriptions. The core cash flow is incredibly stable. It perfectly absorbs the shock. It fundamentally acts like your cash bucket.
Okay, if I followed.
Then you have the B variable, the free growth. As soon as the broader economy even slightly stabilizes, that zero cost growth violently kicks back in. It costs them nothing to capture the recovery. It acts precisely like your growth bucket.
So the business entity itself is perfectly handling the extreme volatility for me.
Yes. They pay the absolute lowest volatility tax because the A structurally protects the downside and the B effortlessly accelerates the upside recovery. They extract wealth straight from time.
So while the frantic day trader is stressing out, paying massive short-term taxes, trying to perfectly time the bottom of the market, the free surfer investor is just sitting there doing literally nothing.
Precisely. Traders aggressively try to extract return from the market itself. Free surfers extract return internally from the physical structure of the business. You aren't playing a game against the house. You actually own the house.
This is a lot to wrap my head around. My brain is fully buzzing right now.
Yeah.
We've got physics with the gradient, thermodynamics with irreversibility, chemistry with autocatalysis, and math with Shannon and Mandelbrot. It legitimately feels like a grand unified theory of investing.
That is exactly what Dubé built. It is a grand unified theory. It's a reinforcing loop. And this is where the systems thinking part of the deep dive ties it all beautifully together.
Systems thinking. This is like the Peter Singer, Danella Meadows stuff, learning to see the whole entire elephant, not just feeling the trunk or the tail.
Right. It's not just a disconnected list of smart scientific laws. They all profoundly connect to each other. It is an unstoppable flywheel. Let's walk clearly through the 8-step loop exactly as described in the source material. Imagine this as a continuously spinning circle.
Okay, paint the picture of the loop for me.
Step 1, the broader ways grows. That's our irreversibility. The whole world inevitably goes more digital. Step two, the company's revenue grows without needing new capital. That's the freebie in action.
Got it.
Step three, because capital costs are zero, the free cash flow of the business expands incredibly rapidly. Step four, the company uses that massive pile of cash to systematically buy back their own stock. That part is purely mechanical.
Which constantly reduces the total share count.
Yeah.
Which mathematically increases the proportional value of every single remaining share I own.
Exactly. Step five, the free cash flow per share radically accelerates. Step six, the broader market clearly notices this acceleration and re-rates the stock much higher. The actual stock price goes way up.
And then what?
Step seven, because the market cap is now huge, passive capital blindly flows into it via indexed products and ETFs.
Darwinian selection. The bigger the company gets, the more the giant S&P 500 ETF is literally forced to buy it every single day.
And finally, step eight. The overarching wave grows even further. That is the autocatalysis. And the entire loop starts over again, but now spinning on a much higher base.
It's just a massive flywheel that completely feeds itself.
The free surfer is what complex systems theorists call an attractor. Global capital relentlessly flows there because the deep physics demands it, not because of some temporary Wall Street hype or a flashy CEO.
So bringing it back down to earth, what does this actually mean for us? For the listener sitting there right now, maybe the guy exactly like me, staring blankly at his phone at midnight, thinking, okay, I totally get the science, I see the beautiful loop, but what do I actually do tomorrow morning?
This is honestly the hardest part of the entire framework. The ultimate conclusion involves a fundamental, very uncomfortable identity shift for the investor. You have to aggressively stop being the engine and start strictly being the physicist.
Break down the exact difference for me. Engine versus physicist.
The traditional investor falsely thinks they are the engine. They think their daily decisions create the returns. I need to buy this stock. I need to sell that bond. I need to rebalance this quarter. I need to read this huge analyst report. They genuinely think their frenetic activity generates the value. They feel like if they ever stop working, the returns stop.
That's that classic action bias we all have. We are wired to think doing something is always vastly better than doing nothing.
Exactly. It feels productive to click buttons. But the free surfer investor realizes the scientific laws are the actual engine. Broad thermodynamics is driving the core growth, not you. Market chemistry is accelerating it, not you. Frankly, the management team at Visa isn't even really driving it. The massive secular trend is.
So your only real job is just observation.
Your job is to accurately identify the physical structure, see the gradient clearly, properly size the position in your portfolio, and then critically get completely out of the way.
The extreme discipline of inaction.
It is incredibly, painfully difficult to execute. We are deeply trained by society to be active. We falsely equate activity with value. We think, if I'm not speed reading 10 earnings reports a day, I'm not really investing. But the true physics of compounding says, if the natural laws are strongly operating, your frantic action actively destroys value. You are just constantly interrupting the compound interest.
It's kind of like baking a delicate right.
Yeah.
If you keep anxiously opening the oven door to check on it every 5 minutes, what invariably happens?
It totally collapses. You are just letting all the vital heat out of the system.
So we basically just need to keep the oven door firmly closed.
The source suggests replacing your daily anxiety with an annual question. Instead of waking up every single day frantically asking, what do I buy right now? You calmly ask once a year, are the fundamental laws still operating?
Like, is global digitalization still broadly advancing? Is passive investing still reliably growing its market share?
Yes. If the answer is yes, and for structural monopolies like Visa, S&P, and Moody's, the answer has been a resounding yes for 30 straight years, then you literally do nothing. You confidently let time be the core variable that does the heavy lifting.
It almost sounds too zen, but it's rigorously backed by hard empirical science.
And importantly, it offers something incredibly rare in the chaotic financial markets, certainty. The source makes a really brilliant comparison to ASML, the massive European semiconductor company. ASML is an objectively amazing company. They literally create the complex machines that print the advanced chips.
Right. Without their specific machines, there are no advanced chips anywhere.
So ASML might actually grow faster than Visa in a really hot boom cycle. When AI chips are crazy hot, ASML is an absolute rocket ship.
But the hardware chip market is famously cyclical. It's massive boom and then brutal bust.
Exactly. Free surfers offer long-term certainty because underlying physics doesn't ever take a sabbatical. Entropy doesn't just take a year off because the Fed changed interest rates.
Yeah.
The structural move from heavy atoms to light bits simply does not reverse.
That is honestly a very comforting thought. Real physics is always on the clock.
Always working for you in the background.
Before we fully wrap up this deep dive, let's leave the listener with a final provocation. Something deep to chew on while they look at their own portfolio tomorrow.
There is a very famous, slightly terrifying statistical study by a professor named Hendrik Bessembinder. He rigorously analyzed the entire recorded history of the U.S. stock market. Thousands and thousands of stocks over nearly a full century. He conclusively found that a mere 4% of all stocks ever created literally all the net wealth in the entire market.
Wait, hold on. 4%. What exactly happened to the other 96% of companies?
The other 96% effectively just matched boring short-term treasury bills, or they slowly went straight to zero. They were just mathematical noise. Think deeply about that. If you pick a stock completely at random, you statically have a 96% chance of buying something that will absolutely not make you rich.
That is just terrifying. But it perfectly explains why active stock picking is historically so brutally hard.
It perfectly explains why most brilliant people fail at this game. But here is the profound connection back to our source. The free surfer is the incredibly rare species that flawlessly obeys all the natural laws, physics, chemistry, information theory simultaneously. And that obedience is what keeps them permanently inside that tiny 4% wealth bracket.
So the real question you need to ask yourself isn't just, what do I log in and buy today?
No. The question is, honestly, look at your portfolio right now. Are you making a fragile bet on some random CEO's daily decision? Are you nervously betting on a new product launch beating estimates next quarter? Or are you structurally betting on irreversible entropy? Because human CEOs routinely get fired. Shiny products totally fail. Hungry competitors constantly emerge. But entropy just inevitably, relentlessly increases.
I think I definitely know which one I would rather comfortably bet my retirement on.
Me too.
This has been a truly mind-expanding look at Averaging Up, The Infinite Investor by Jocelyn Dubey. I kind of feel like I need to go find my high school physics teacher and seriously apologize for not paying better attention in class.
It is honestly never too late to learn the laws of nature.
Very true. Thanks for joining us for another deep dive into the source material. Go carefully check your gradients, evaluate your B variables, and we will catch you in the next one.